If you're a parent who's ever thought to themselves, you know, I might be the worst parent ever, then please let me assure you that chances are you're not. If you need evidence to prove it, then a quick Google search for worst parent ever should quench your concerns. As a matter of fact, it would probably blow your mind how many stories are actually online about the insane antics of America's worst parents. And listen, there are many stories online that just fall into the category of parents who actually use shock collars and tasers on their own children in order to discipline them. You can find a plethora of stories just on those topics alone. Now listen, parents, if you're using a taser in order to make your kids eat their veggies, then you might be one of the worst parents ever. Hopefully, no one here falls into that category. Now, the fact is that the internet is filled with stories about horrible parents who do horrible things to their kids. And yet, at the same time, I would also suggest here that the Bible is also filled with many candidates who would probably make it onto a worst parent ever list. And you know what's sad? Well, it's sad to say that King David himself would more than likely make the list. As a matter of fact, here in our study today, we're going to spend some time exploring some of the problems that occurred as a result of David's poor parenting decisions. And from his example, we're going to see, first of all, how bad parents raise their kids with the wrong relational example. We're also going to see that bad parents raise their kids with the wrong punishment principle. And finally, today we'll see that bad parents raise their kids with the wrong familial pedestal. Well, with this as our outline, I want to open our Bibles to 2 Samuel chapter 13, because there we find King David. He's facing a few of the problems that come from bad parenting decisions. As you make your way to 2 Samuel 13, I should begin by sharing my own skepticism about David's ability to be a good father to all of his children. And I know some of you are like, oh, let's get this guy. He's talking bad about King David. But before you get all bent out of shape, let me first explain what I mean here, because we have to understand that the Bible actually mentions 19 sons of David. And the Bible mentions one daughter by name who we find here in our text today. I'm going to guess, because the text also mentions the daughters of the king, that David had more than one daughter. What this means is that David had over 20 kids that he was attempting to raise. Now, let's just say that he was a full-time stay-at-home dad. He's already maxed out, right? But he wasn't just a full-time dad, a stay-at-home dad. No, we have to remember here that David, he was the king of Israel. He was the leader of a nation. He was the commander-in-chief of Israel's army. And with an entire nation to lead and military campaigns to prayerfully deploy, I would argue that David might have limited himself to, I don't know, let's say one wife and just had a couple of kids. That would be more reasonable. Unfortunately for all of his kids, David's lust for the ladies led him into the practice of polygamy, resulting in a plethora of undisciplined children. Here in our text today, we find a story that presents us with the ugly problems that come along with bad parenting. And with this as our focus, I want to begin our study of 2 Samuel 13. And so if you would, look with me, beginning there at verse 1, because there we read that after this, Absalom, the son of David, had a lovely sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. Now, let's just stop right here, because we're already in the first verse beginning to experience some weirdness in this family. And it'll help us to understand the identities of those who are mentioned here in the opening verse of this chapter. And the first person that we find here in 2 Samuel 13, it's a young man named Absalom. I'll remind you that we were first introduced to Absalom in 2 Samuel chapter 3. And we learn that Absalom was David's third son who was born to his wife who was named Maacah. Well, not only are we reintroduced to David's third son here, but we're also introduced to David's daughter, whose name was Tamar. And we learn here that Tamar was Absalom's sister, which tells us that she was also the daughter of David's wife, Maacah. Not only that, but here in verse 1, we also discover that Tamar was a lovely gal. Or in other words, Absalom's sister Tamar, she was a girl who was considered to be very bright and very beautiful. Unfortunately for her, well, her beauty attracted the attention of the wrong guy. Now, just as a sidebar note, ladies, I want to take a moment to point out that a woman who attempts to attract attention to themselves by accentuating their beauty and by advertising their body with the low-cut blouses and the short skirts, I'm here to tell you that you're going to typically attract the attention of those guys whose relational commitments are quickly broken the minute another prettier gal draws his attention away. If that's what they're attracted to, if that's what they're going for is beauty, well, their attention is drawn away the minute someone prettier comes along. Now, it's easy for a woman to walk away from that kind of a situation and say, all guys are dogs. All guys are dogs. Well, listen, if you put yourself out there like a piece of meat, don't be surprised if you attract the dogs. We have to understand something here. Peter encouraged Christian women to let their beauty be seen in the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of the Lord. Now, he's not saying, hey, be quiet, women. But he is saying, hey, if you want to focus on being beautiful, start with the inside. I'm not telling Christian women what they should or should not wear, but what I am saying is that the clothes that advertise the physical beauty of a woman will more than likely attract the attention of the wrong guys. And this seems to be what was happening in Tamar's life here in our text today. As a matter of fact, if you would look with me there at verse 1, because there we read again that Absalom, the son of David, had a lovely sister whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her. Now here in this verse, we learn that David's firstborn son, Amnon, had fallen in love with David's daughter, Tamar. I should point out that while Amnon and Tamar, they had the same father, but they had different mothers. And so Tamar, she was the daughter of David's wife, Maacah, and Amnon was the son of David's wife, Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess. And though they weren't full-blooded siblings, Amnon still knew that his feelings for his half-sister Tamar were completely off base. As a matter of fact, if you would look with me beginning at verse 2, there we learn that Amnon was so distressed over his sister Tamar that he became sick, for she was a virgin. And it was improper for Amnon to do anything to her. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimei, David's brother. Now Jonadab was a very crafty man. And he said to him, "Why are you, the king's son, becoming thinner day after day? Will you not tell me?" Amnon said to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." So Jonadab said to him, "Lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Please let my sister Tamar come and give me food and prepare the food in my sight that I may see it and eat it from her hand.'" Now here in these verses, we discover that Amnon, he was so distressed over his feelings that he had for his half-sister that he actually became physically ill, even to the point that he was losing weight. And so he was feeling sick and he couldn't eat. And the reason why is due to the fact that he knew that his feelings for his half-sister were improper feelings. But rather than taking his sinful desires to the Lord, rather than repenting of this wickedness, Amnon ended up receiving counsel from his close friend and his cousin, whose name was Jonadab. Unfortunately for him, his good friend and his cousin, well, he didn't give him good counsel. Notice with me again there in the middle of verse 3. There we learn that Jonadab was a very crafty man. Or in other words, Jonadab was a deceitfully clever guy. He was very wise in the ways of wickedness. And while Amnon would have done well to just go and seek advice from a person like Nathan the prophet, He instead decided to listen to the evil schemes of his crafty cousin. There in verse 5, we find Jonadab telling him to pretend to be ill. Now, that's not the word ill that we use today, like when you're telling someone to be hip and cool and trendy. Hey, man, you're really ill. Do they, kids still say that anymore? No. That's not the kind of ill he's talking about. Pretend to be cool. Pretend to be ill. No, he's saying pretend to be sick. Pretend to be ill, and that way David will send Tamar to come and take care of you. Jonadab thought he was helping his cousin. But the fact is, he was really helping to destroy his life. As we consider Jonadab's advice here, it's important for us to understand what Paul meant when he told Christians that evil company corrupts good habits. Evil company corrupts good habits. In other words, every Christian runs the risk of following the carnal counsel of the wicked whenever we choose to listen to the Jonadabs of this world. I have no doubt that we all know a Jonadab or two. A person who's ready to come along and offer you counsel, but the counsel is not biblical counsel. They're ready to give you advice. They're ready to point you into a certain direction, and yet that direction is contrary to God's revealed will. Instead of seeking godly guidance from the Jonadabs of this world, we ought to be seeking godly guidance from the Nathans of this world. We ought to go find the prophets of this world. We ought to go find those who know God's word and know how to counsel people accordingly. That way, when the Jonadabs of this world come along and attempt to point us in the wrong direction, when the Jonadabs of this world come and try to give us ungodly counsel, we can say to them, you know what, that doesn't line up with the scriptures. And by the way, hey, let me tell you about Jesus. He died for our sins. We got to be counseling the Jonadabs of this world to seek the Lord and the grace that he offers. Unfortunately for Amnon, he didn't seek out a Nathan. He listened to Jonadab. He heeded the advice of Jonadab. And beginning there at verse 6, we learn that Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, "Please let Tamar, my sister, come and make a couple of cakes for me in my sight that I may eat from her hand." And David sent home to Tamar, saying, "Now go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food for him." So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, and he was lying down. Then she took flour and kneaded it, made cakes in his sight, and baked the cakes. And she took the pan and placed them out before him, but he refused to eat. Then Amnon said, "Have everyone go out from me." And they all went out from him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, "Bring the food into the bedroom that I may eat from your hand." And Tamar took the cakes which she had made and brought them to Amnon, her brother, in the bedroom. Now when she had brought them to him to eat, he took hold of her and said to her, "Come lie with me, my sister." But she answered him, "No, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing should be done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing. And I, where could I take my shame? And as for you, you would be like one of the fools in Israel. Now, therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you." Now here in these verses, we find Amnon following the carnal counsel of his cousin Jonadab. And once he was alone in the room with his half-sister Tamar, he presented her with the wicked proposition of an incestuous relationship. And she was right in telling him no. And she tells him here, no such thing should be done in all of Israel. And I'm here to tell you that no such thing should be done in America either. She was correct in concluding that this sexual sin should never be committed. And yet at the same time, Tamar seemed to be making some level of provision for the possibility of this relationship. As a matter of fact, notice with me again there at the end of verse 13, because there Tamar declares, "Now, therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you." Now, wait, what? What is she saying here? I mean, what kind of twisted family is this? That Amnon was pursuing a physical relationship with his half-sister, and in her mind, this would have been sort of acceptable so long as her father signed off on it. Not only that, but I have to ask, What kind of man did she think her father was? What kind of man did she think her father was? What would lead her to believe that King David would approve of this incestuous relationship? Now, we'll talk more about that here in a few minutes, but for now, I just want to take a look at Amnon's response. If you would look with me there at verse 14. There we learn that Amnon would not heed her voice, and being stronger than she, he forced her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. And Amnon said to her, "Arise, be gone." So she said to him, "No, indeed, this evil of sending me away is worse than the other that you did to me." But he would not listen to her. Then he called his servant who attended him and said, "Here, put this woman out, away from me, and bolt the door behind her." Now she had on a robe of many colors, for the king's virgin daughters wore such apparel. And his servant put her out and bolted the door behind her. Then Tamar put ashes on her head and tore her robe of many colors that was on her and laid her hand on her head and went away crying bitterly. Now here in these verses we find Amnon, and he's forcing himself upon his half-sister. And from this, we see that he was not only engaging in just a wicked act of incest, but he's also committing the sexual assault of rape. It's sad to say that according to the research conducted by the Colorado Coalition Against Sexual Assault, one out of six women here in the United States have experienced an attempted or a completed rape. And it's heartbreaking to say that another researcher goes on to reveal that incestuous rape among siblings is considered to be very widespread and yet rarely reported. And so there's all sorts of incestual rape happening, but typically it's never reported. Now, if you're a woman who has suffered an attempted or even a completed rape, I want to encourage you this morning in two ways. First of all, if you've been the victim of a rape, then I would encourage you to take your pain to the Lord and to continue to take your pain to the Lord. No doubt that you're struggling with the pain of that rape. The emotional pain probably haunts you to this day. But I'm here to tell you that the Lord wants to heal you. The Lord wants to restore you. I would even go further and promise you that the Lord wants to transform your life, so that you can leave that pain in the past, and so that you can even become the kind of Christian woman who can help another rape victim out. And so take your pain to the Lord and continue taking your pain to the Lord. He's right there and he wants to help you and transform your life. Secondly, though, I want to help you to understand this morning that it's not your fault. Chances are, if you've been the victim of a rape, then you've probably played it over in your mind several times. Well, if I wouldn't have been wearing those clothes, or if I hadn't have gone to that place, or if I would have just fought harder. And chances are, you've just played it over and blamed yourself time and time again. And I'm here to tell you to stop. Stop blaming yourself. It is not your fault. You just can't spend the rest of your life blaming yourself, because it is not your fault. Now, as a man, I'm here to tell you, no man ever has the right to force themselves upon a woman. No man has that right. And husbands, listen. Your marriage license is not a license to force your wife to have sex with you. If she says no, then it's no. Just because you're married, you don't have the right to force her to have a sexual relationship with you. Unfortunately, there are men like Amnon in the world, cowardly men, who believe that the ability to overpower a woman gives them the right to rape. And it's sad to say that there are even many cases of sibling-sibling incest, which could have been prevented by the presence of a strong father. That's right, according to a study that was presented in 1999, the absence of the father has been found to be a significant element in most cases of sexual abuse of a female child by her brother. And I'm guessing that this probably was a contributing factor in the case of Amnon and Tamar. With this in mind, if you would, look with me there at verse 20, because there we learn that Absalom, her brother, said to her, "Has Amnon, your brother, been with you? But now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this thing to heart." So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. But when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. Now here in these verses, we find Tamar's brother, Absalom. We find him showing more concern about the well-being of his sister than their father David did. It seems to me that he was the one who was able to put two and two together and draw the obvious conclusion. Remember, Tamar went over to her half-brother Amnon's house and then left that house weeping with a torn robe and ash on her head. Based on all of these details, Absalom quickly came to the obvious conclusion that she had been raped by their half-brother Amnon. Now, he told Tamar to let it go. And yet we'll discover here in a few minutes that Absalom didn't let it go at all. We'll actually find him administering street justice. But now as we consider the way that Tamar went to her brother Absalom's house, I can't help but to wonder, why didn't she go and seek help from her father? Why didn't she run straight home and say, "Hey, Dad, let me tell you what Amnon just did"? Why didn't she go seek help from her father? Well, if I had to guess why, then the chances are she probably thought that her dad would take the side of Amnon rather than taking her side. She probably came to the conclusion that her dad was going to be on Amnon's side because he's the firstborn son. And we'll talk more about David's relationship with Amnon here in a few minutes. But to prove my point, I just want to remind you that she already told Amnon that David would probably give her to him. Notice again there at the end of verse 13. There Tamar pleaded with her half-brother and said, "Speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you." Now, it's very possible that Tamar's statement was false. We can't draw the conclusion that she was properly representing David's heart. And yet, at the same time, it's how she saw her dad. This was her perspective on her father. She literally believed that her dad would give her to her half-brother. And what this means is that she didn't see her father as a man that she could trust. She didn't see her dad as a safe place to go to and to get help from. It's for this reason that David, well, he had to hear about this rape from somebody else. Notice with me again there, verse 21. There we learn that when King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. From this we see that David had to hear about the rape of his daughter from another person. We don't know who the source was, but all we know is that David had to hear about this rape. And when he received this report about Tamar's rape, yeah, he was very angry. He was extremely disappointed with the actions of his sons. And while David, well, he had the right to be disappointed with Amnon, what he was failing to recognize was his own culpability. What do I mean by that? Well, we have to remember something. David was a man who had 8 wives. David was a man who had many concubines. And not only that, but we must remember that he acquired his last wife by murdering her husband in order to cover up their adulterous relationship. Is it any wonder that Tamar sought help from her brother Absalom rather than going to her father David? Is it any wonder? Listen, it's unlikely that a daughter is going to seek help from a father who's been unfaithful to her mother because he's no longer a safe place. It's even more unlikely that a daughter will seek help from a father who's willing to murder a man and steal his wife. I'm guessing that Tamar saw her father as a very evil person. Not only that, but let's consider Amnon. Because a son who grows up watching his father disrespecting his mother by chasing other women, that son will probably grow up and treat other women with the same sort of disrespect. Fathers, if your son watches you disrespect your wife and his mother, you better believe that your son will probably grow up being a man who disrespects women. As we consider the relational example that David presented to his sons, it's no wonder why Amnon decided that, hey, it's okay to pursue a relationship with my half-sister. I mean, my dad's done much worse, right? Christian, listen. We can't raise our kids like David raised his. We can't raise our kids with this mentality of do as I say and not as I do. It doesn't work. History tells us that kids tend to follow in the footsteps of their parents. Kids tend to do as parents do, not as they say. Therefore, it's important for every parent to do the best they can by the power of the Holy Spirit to present their kids with the right relational example. Fathers ought to be respecting their wives and raising their kids and helping them to see that they are a safe place to go to. Unfortunately, David, he was a bad parent, and he was raising his children with the wrong relational example. But not only that, he was also a bad parent because he was raising his children with the wrong punishment principle. Now, with this in mind, let's continue to make our way through 2 Samuel chapter 13, because there we find David, he's failing to present the proper punishment for his son Amnon. If you would look with me there at verse 22. There we learn that Absalom spoke to his brother Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. And it came to pass after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim. So Absalom invited all the king's sons. Then Absalom came to the king and said, "Kindly note, your servant has sheep shearers. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant." But the king said to Absalom, "No, my son, let us not all go now, lest we be a burden to you." Then he urged him, but he would not go, and he blessed him. Then Absalom said, "If not, please let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said to him, "Why should he go with you?" But Absalom urged him, so he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Now here in these verses, we learn that for 2 years, 2 entire full years, Absalom didn't say one word to his brother Amnon. He didn't say anything good. He didn't say anything bad. He just wasn't saying anything. What this text also seems to suggest to me here, though, is that for 2 full years, David failed to discipline his firstborn son for raping his daughter. 2 years went by, and there was no justice. 2 years went by, and Amnon got off scot-free. And that's when Absalom decided to take matters into his own hands. And he did this by first setting an ambush. He set a trap. He asked all of his brothers to attend a party in Baal Hazor, which was near Ephraim. You would look with me beginning at verse 28, because there we learn that Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, "Watch now, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not be afraid. Have I not commanded you? Be courageous and valiant." So the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and each one got on his mule and fled. And it came to pass while they were on the way that news came to David saying, "Absalom has killed all the king's sons, and not one of them is left." So the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the ground, and all his servants stood by with their clothes torn. Now, here in these verses, we find Absalom, he's exacting revenge on his half-brother Amnon. And while I'm certainly not condoning revenge, I do believe that swift justice is an important part of every healthy society. And since there seems to have been no justice for Tamar, I guess that Absalom took it upon himself to punish the king's firstborn son. I'm guessing that his fiery passion for vengeance would have been quenched if his father David would have just stepped in to properly punish Amnon for raping Tamar. Unfortunately, David was raising his children with the wrong punishment principle, which means this. David was failing to raise them with biblical principles through proper punishment. It's sad to say that many parents in the world today have a similar approach to parenting. Rather than raising their kids with proper punishments, which are designed to help them to define the biblical principles of right and wrong, many parents in the world today are simply allowing their kids to get away with anything and everything. And not only do they personally refuse to discipline their own children, but they resent any other adult who attempts to correct their kids. As a result, there are many kids growing up today with the belief that they're never wrong. And they believe nobody can tell them what to do. They can't handle constructive criticism, and they can't handle when somebody tells them that they've done something wrong. Times have changed indeed. Because it wasn't like this when I was a kid. Many of you know what I'm talking about. When I was a kid, my dad would work me over if I looked like I was thinking about doing something wrong. Next thing you know, I'm getting a hand in the back of the head. What's going on? I saw you thinking. Chances are you were thinking about doing something wrong. It's a preemptive punishment. Not only that, but all of my teachers at school had the privilege to punish, and they had the power of the paddle. I had one teacher, just very large lady, and she would light you up. She had a paddle that was cut in the shape of a hand, and she had holes in it to cut down on the wind resistance. And she'd make you grab your ankles and just start swinging. I feared her more than anyone. And not only could the teacher give you paddling for cutting up, but then the teacher would then call your house to let your parents know that they had given you a paddle. And I don't know what happened to other kids when they got home, but when I got home, I got punished for getting punished. My dad knew nothing about double jeopardy. I would get punished because I got punished. How is that fair? On top of that, I'm pretty sure that all the parents at some point in time called every other parent and gave each other the right to spank every other person's kid around the block. Every parent has spanking privileges. And I'd be down the street and I'm acting like a joker, and all of a sudden, a parent would swoop out of nowhere like Batman and take off their utility belt and just work me all the way home. The good old days, when every parent had the power to discipline any kid at any time for any reason, those days are over. Teachers aren't allowed to spank misbehaving kids at school anymore. Many of you know that Brenda used to teach at Fulmore Middle School. Most of those kids need spankings there. But she'd be dealing with, all kinds of different kids, and sometimes she'd call a parent and say, hey, your kid's misbehaving, and that parent sometimes would respond, in the right way. And the child would come back the next day, and they're behaving correctly. But there were many times that Brenda came home and told me about a phone call that she had with a parent, and she would call and say, hey, your child's misbehaving, and the parent would go off on Brenda, scold her for even daring to suggest that their child could do anything wrong. In their eyes, their kid could do nothing wrong. Kind of like the other day, I was having lunch at Chewy's, and there was a little kid in the booth right behind me. And those booths at Chewy's, they're kind of springy. And there was a kid jumping on the booth right behind me like it was a trampoline. And he was screaming at the top of his lungs like he was out at the park. Now, this behavior would have been absolutely appropriate if he were on a trampoline at the park. But it was lunchtime, we're in a restaurant, and this kid was screaming, just right in my ear. His head was right here, and he just screaming at the top of his lungs. Well, right after my eardrum ruptured, I turned to the child's clueless mother, and I thought, well, maybe she has hearing damage too. Because clearly she's not hearing what I'm hearing right now. And very politely, I asked her, you know, can you maybe curb your child a little bit here? Can you ask them to calm down until you guys get outside? Well, rather than disciplining her own child, this mother began to chide me. Somehow, I had crossed the line of what is acceptable behavior in a social setting. I crossed the line? I'm the one that's wrong? Parents, please understand that according to the Scriptures, every good parent is going to present their kids with the correct consequences for the crimes they commit. And we have to understand, the Bible tells us, every person has fallen short of the glory of God. What that means is that we're all sinners. So the parent who truly believes that their child never does anything wrong, delusional. It's delusional. Maybe you have a child who knows how to hide what they do wrong. That was the difference between me and my brother. I'm just like, I'm wrong. Look at me. I'm a big sinner. And my brother was very covert. He looked like he never did anything wrong, but he just knew how to hide it. If you want to raise kids who understand right from wrong, if you want to raise kids who know how to receive constructive criticism later in life or know how to receive correction, then correct them now. And if you don't see them ever doing anything wrong, pay a little more attention. Because they're doing something wrong. According to the wisest man to ever live, Solomon, he said, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. Not my child. Yeah, your child. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child. The rod of correction will drive it far from him. Now, I'm not suggesting that you beat your kids. But I would argue that they need to be disciplined. Solomon also insists that the rod and rebuke give wisdom. Do you want your children to grow up to be wise? Then they need to be rebuked from time to time. And they need to be punished from time to time. The rod and rebuke give wisdom. And then Solomon says, a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. And it's sad to say that David seems to have left his children to themselves. And as a result, they brought shame to their mother. And it's unfortunate that for Amnon, Absalom, and Tamar, David not only raised his children with the wrong parental example by engaging in polygamy and adultery and even murder, he also raised his kids with the wrong punishment principle, which resulted in kids who lacked the discipline that they truly needed. Finally, though, we should consider how David was a bad parent because he raised his kids with the wrong familial pedestal. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, if you would, let's continue to make our way through 2 Samuel chapter 13, because here we find David placing his son Amnon on a pedestal. If you would look with me there at verse 32, here we learn that Jonadab, the son of Shimei, David's brother, answered and said, let not my lord suppose they have killed all the young men, the king's sons, for only Amnon is dead. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar. Now, therefore, let not my lord the king take the thing to his heart to think that all the king's sons are dead, for only Amnon is dead. Then Absalom fled, and the young man who was keeping watch lifted his eyes and looked, and there many people were coming from the road on the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said to the king, look, the king's sons are coming, as your servant said, so it is. So it was, as soon as he had finished speaking, that the king's sons indeed came, and they lifted up their voice and wept. Also the king and all his servants wept very bitterly. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And King David longed to go to Absalom, for he had been comforted concerning Amnon because he was dead. Now, here in the final verses of this sad and tragic chapter of the Bible, we find David's third son, Absalom, running for his life. He's taking refuge in the city of his maternal grandfather there in Geshur. And while there's no doubt that he was guilty of premeditated murder, I also want to take into consideration the fact that the fire of Absalom's rage would have been fueled by the accelerant of injustice. Chances are, Absalom's desire for revenge, it could have been quenched if David would have simply stepped in to punish his firstborn son. Unfortunately for Tamar and Absalom, it seems as if David had placed Amnon on some sort of familial pedestal. I'm guessing that in the eyes of David, his firstborn son could do no wrong. His firstborn son, he's an angel. And so while he should have been the one to punish Amnon with swift justice, David placed his firstborn son on the wrong familial pedestal, which was far above parental punishment. And David did nothing about Amnon's decision to rape his sister. Meanwhile, Tamar just had to suffer. Tamar suffered in her misery. And Absalom, well, he just had to continue to stew in his own anger until he made the decision to go and kill his half-brother. From this we see that David was a father who was showing favoritism to his firstborn son. And not only was this favoritism seen in Amnon's lack of punishment, but it could also be seen in David's mourning. Notice with me again there at the end of verse 37. There we learn that David mourned every day over the loss of his firstborn son. Every day he mourned over the death of Amnon. It's sad to say that throughout this entire chapter, there's no mention of one tear being shed for his daughter Tamar. Not one tear shed for the trauma that she endured. Nor was there any mourning for his son Absalom, who was now on the run for his life after avenging his sister's honor. And it's sad to say that David didn't even seem to care about Absalom for at least 3 years. For 3 years, he did nothing about going to see his son to say, hey, I understand why you did this. Hey, don't worry, we'll try to fix this with the court system. We'll attempt to do our best to work through this. No, for 3 years, not a word to his son Absalom, which only goes to show that David was a father who was raising his kids with the wrong familial pedestal. David was a father who favored his firstborn son above all the others. And based on his reactions to this tragic situation, it was evident to all of his kids that Amnon had been placed on this pedestal. In this way, David was suffering from the problems that come along with bad parenting. He had placed one of his kids upon a pedestal, and it caused problems. You see, when parents display favoritism among their children, they actually end up scarring their kids for life. For example, the favored kid, who found themselves always on the parental pedestal, they grow up with a false sense of entitlement. They think everything should be theirs, and they have this inability to receive correction because they weren't corrected by their parents. And so those who become parental favorites, well, they're scarred for life because they think they can do no wrong and nobody can tell them what to do. But then the kids who failed to find their way up to the familial pedestal, they oftentimes end up struggling with jealousy and anger and resentment. And according to the research, most of these kids end up depressed for the rest of their lives. Always attempting to please the people around them, so they become people pleasers, but never really feeling like they actually accomplish that mission. Now, I want to recognize that it's easy for parents to find themselves connecting with one child more easily than another. Just based on temperament types and just based on personality types, it's oftentimes that a mom might see, you know, that she more easily connects with this son or that daughter. A father might look at this son or that daughter and say, you know, I just really get them because they're much like me. And so it's easy to see a parent who more easily connects with one child over another. That's not uncommon. And yet at the same time, it's still important to make sure that the favoritism of the familial pedestal is reserved solely for the Lord. The Lord has to be first in your family. the Lord has to be placed on that pedestal. And then the Lord will work out all of the other relational issues. If Jesus is first in your family, then Jesus will help you to solve all the other relational problems that occur within a marriage and within a family. Then, rather than playing favorites, the Lord will help parents to make sure that every child is loved equally and that every child is also punished equally. Well, without debate, raising children has got to be one of the toughest things that a person will ever set out to do. And yet, despite the difficulty of raising kids, it's important for every parent to seek the Lord for help. It's important for every parent to seek help from the Holy Spirit so that we might avoid raising our children with the wrong relational example, so that parents can avoid raising children with the wrong punishment principle, and so that parents can avoid making the mistake of raising their kids with the wrong familial pedestal. I'm here to tell you that if Christian parents would simply take the time to get to know the families found in the Bible and to learn from their mistakes, then they'll be well beyond the curve. If Christian parents would just take the time to explore the Scriptures and to find out how parents in the past did things wrong and how parents in the past did things right, and then follow the right examples and avoid the wrong examples, then every Christian parent here today can avoid the mistakes that David made. And then by the grace of God, we can help our families and we can help our kids to avoid the problems that come along with bad parenting. Let's pray.